Hello, good evening. And I guess this is an episode of Stan on the Boomer. I'm not sure if we're still using that, but I'm actually back on my own YouTube channel, which is nice. After missing my own last two streams.
The last one wasn't yours, that was mine.
Okay, you started your own stream, and then I didn't appear on last week's stream because I was tired and also busy. But we do have joining us today, I'll go straight in there, Mr. Tho Bishop, one of the I guess alumni of the Mises Institute.
Yes, yeah, glad to join you guys.
Is it your assistant editor, is it? Or
Correct. Yes.
yes, I thought I got that right.
Well,
Sorry,
yeah.
I thought I had your page open. I'm scrambling to find it so I don't say something stupid. But no, we thought we'd get Mr. Tho Bishop on because he recently released, well, you put up a version of something Rothbard wrote in 1993,
Yes.
just to get into it, and it's amazing how synchronous it is with some of the stuff we've been talking about, because we've been reading a lot of both Sam Francis and Rothbard to develop our series about 20th century democratization. So it was kind of interesting to see that. It's also the chapter in something I've taken to calling the Rothbardian time machine, where he seems to just reach out and comment on things that hadn't happened in his lifetime yet.
I think there's a Radlib that keeps saying, as we get older, Rothbard gets smarter every day.
He has that tendency. It's pretty incredible. Like, particularly something like this. I mean, I've been looking at some of his '90s stuff, and I kind of just overlooked it just because it was a book review, and I just didn't give it the attention I needed. And the fact that there's so many of these intellectuals from the '90s being rediscovered, for one, it's a reminder of just how much of a dark age the 2000s really were, just intellectually on the right. Just because you recognize there's all this great progress being made, and then it's just 9/11 happens, and it all just goes out the window. And now we're just kind of rediscovering, 20 years later, some of the stuff we should be, or 30 years later now, some of the stuff we should have been paying attention to much earlier.
Yeah, the piece in question is just brilliant, though. It's so Rothbard. It's that he's writing a review on a 250-ish page book and decides to write 8,000 words, most of which is about bizarre elements of ideology, elitism, Lenin, and all sorts of other stuff we might try and get through this evening.
It even has the Lenin stuff in there, which again,
It's peak Rothbard.
it's brilliant.
Well, everything old is new again. Especially in when you get to Rothbard's essays, because it is kind of as a review, it's more like an essay with a review scattered through it, which makes it quite interesting to read.
And it's interesting because, like, the degree to which Rothbard really focuses on strategy in the 90s, you definitely see where, this essay just radiates the amount of influence those halls and the John Randolph Society meetings, that cross-pollination of ideas. This, I think, really portrays a very intimate sort of look into the degree to which Sam Francis and some of those conversations had really influenced him in those last, unfortunately, those last 5 years. And it's just a shame we didn't get more of it.
It
It is.
was I like the sort of brief sort of outline and framing at the start as well, where he sort of discusses and makes it very clear, probably to people who had never heard of the literature before, that Francis does not come from standard conservative or paleo-conservative lines at all. He's elbow deep in a theory of Italian sort of elitism that was basically laying dormant, other than Burnham briefly touching on it, who's the other person that's kind of mentioned here. But I just like, as we mentioned Lenin, he takes these sort of Machiavellian political strategies up to the point where, you're like, the key questions are always not necessarily the shape of the structure, but to who does the structure serve and to whom is this serving taken from? I mean, the whole notion of politics as a zero-sum game is something I've been trying to explain to people for, I don't know, too long now.
Oh, before we get, oh, sorry, go on, though.
So yeah, we're just war by other means. Really.
Yes,
absolutely.
Yes, but Before we get too far into it, I'll do the regular normal stream stuff. For those who haven't seen it before, or for those who haven't watched for a while, we are also joined by Evelyn and my usual co-host, and I always call you the stream pusher, which makes you sound like you're in a dark alley with like a coat
like
full
that.
of OBS software.
I have just a coat for it. Big coat. Yeah, no problem. I can sort
you kids,
some,
you want some streams?
There. You want to buy some frames, kids? As always, we are by some miracle still monetized. I just think we're not being noticed. If you want to donate and have your questions read, we do have a Streamlabs. That is the best way to donate to us. Although you can give super chats and you can still join the channel to support us monthly. It does give us beer money at least, and it also helps visibility with the videos because interaction is rated quite highly on YouTube's magical algorithm.
Yes.
apart from that, Evelyn is starting her own show on a Monday. The first episode was with Mr. Peter Quinas. I will add that probably to the description below in her little section. I'll add the playlist there, and there will be more of those. Trig, I think you're doing your weird D&D thing on a Monday, so I might as well show that before we get into the article proper here.
Yes.
Sorry, go
on. I'm being a nerd. I'm playing D&D on a Monday. It's good for a laugh, sort of.
It's good fun.
Exactly.
I'm being less of a nerd on Monday by studying intently an obscure political theory that nobody reads.
Indeed.
What is Monday stream going to be about? Have you got an idea yet?
I don't know. We'll see. Just having a brief look through some of the chapter headings of Beautiful Losers, that looks like there's some rather interesting stuff. So I might have a peruse of that and see if there's anything I want to pick.
That book is incredibly expensive to buy. You know what? I'll pick up a copy if it's a tenner. No, it's like £95 for a softback.
Paperback. Well, the Perito and Giordano Mosca stuff that's mentioned in this article, those books are like £400-£500, some of them, because they've not been printed since like the '50s.
It's amazing, that isn't it? That a lot of it's kind of mentioned in the piece we're going to read itself, but all the stuff just being buried. In fact, though, I want to ask you, where did you find this, this Rothbard essay/review about Beautiful Losers? Because I've never seen this before. I've never heard anyone talk about it before, but it is so relevant. Like, where did you dig this up from?
As far as I can tell, this has not been republished anywhere. There's two scans online just because of the full collection of the Rothbard Rockwell reports. But I think this is the first time there's been an HTML version out there. And again, that's why, I was just going through reading some random stuff, going back and trying to read some of my own favorites, and I saw this article right before it. There's this thing about Italian politics is interesting in its own right, and then I just started reading, and I was, it didn't take far to realize that it was something that was pretty significant. And again, I mean, it's like literally the night before, we were talking about Sam Francis with someone else after one of the Twitter spaces. And so it was just too eerie, just how on the nose it was.
Oh, is that one of the Twitter spaces that isn't named like hashtag Mayo Monkey or something?
Yes. Or why should black people exist? There wasn't that one either.
That's been a whole... The Twitter spaces have been rather entertaining. But it does kind of feel like you've come out of like the online like essay, like Indiana Jones. You've gone to the Rolling Rock. You've replaced the statue with a sandbag. And you've come out with this 1993 Rothbard piece.
And that's one of the things that's really nice about it is that, it's being able to ground a lot of the topics that I'm interested in, within the perspective of great Austrians and trying to really build off of those foundations is something I find really, it makes me feel better than just kind of going off half-cocked. And the Burnham issue is something I've always been interested with Rothbard because, now we have this revival of Burnham. He's a very subversive thinker, right, in many ways on the right. And it's interesting that you wouldn't expect that from one of the headwigs of National Review.
It was was he not also head of the CIA and other elements of the security state for quite a while?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and that's the critique that of Rothbard. He touches on it slightly in this article, but Justin Raimondo's book, Reclaiming the American Right, it's a wonderful book. He's got a whole chapter on Burnham himself, and they really dive into that aspect of Burnham that he was just he so understood that power dynamic that all he just wanted to do was just worship whoever had the power at the time. But I kept trying to figure out what exactly was Rothbard's thoughts on the managerial revolution, on these things. And you know, I had not fully appreciated the degree to which Burnham had inspired Francis. I was passively familiar with the anarcho-tyranny stuff, but I wasn't quite familiar with that direct influence either. And so it was very interesting tying all those loose ends together, and seeing Rothbard's opinion on some of this.
Out of curiosity, have you read Leviathan and Its Enemies?
I have not.
That's. Again, so that's how I guess both of us found Francis,
yeah.
And he's very open about it in Leviathan, and the edited together stuff, because it was a posthumous release book. It was basically his like unfinished magnum opus,
raw and unfiltered.
Yeah, it's a lot different than some of his other writing as well. It's a lot less entertaining in many ways, but it's a lot more analytical. It's honestly a bit more like some of the drier bits of Rothbard in terms of how it's laid out in this language. But he's very open in there about his influence from Burnham. So I think that's actually one of the aspects I already knew, but it's mostly because I've read, I guess one of the few people who's actually read Leviathan and Its Enemies, because that's one of the breakout books Francis's, but it's very dense. I don't think a lot of people could read it, at least on first try, and understand a lot of it, because there's a huge amount of grounding you need, I think, for Leviathan.
Well, no, I was going to say, that's definitely a book that I would put money on becoming more and more important if people take proper conscious sort of analysis of where we actually sit in the scope of political conflict. And one of the key points that this article gets into is, you know, you are not counter-revolutionaries, you are revolutionaries. And Sam Francis is essentially spending 800 words trying to explain to conservatives why they can't be reformists anymore. And it's like a really long-winded way to do it, but in a sort of Rothbardian kind of way, it's only possible because he's capable of such a highly specific level of language. And, you know, the terms you see even later in this article, sort of slightly more Gottfriedisms of the, what is it, the quasi-bureaucratic totalitarian therapeutic managerial state or something like that.
Yeah. Which is kind of funny because it sounds like Rothbard is reading bits from Leviathan, which came out 10 years after this was written. It's this very strange synchronicity. And having read so much of both of them, it's interesting to see this here and see like the synthesis going on that a lot of people are only rediscovering now. You mentioned 9/11, and really, like, as with a lot of these traumatic ratchet events, as it talks about in Crisis and Leviathan, and you know, that's been quite well covered, is that it does this. It has this like amnesia effect on the population, where, you know, what came before is no longer remembered after these events. 9/11 was the big one of those for the modern American right. They essentially just had surrendered to the neocons after that, out of the trauma of 9/11. And it's interesting, again, we should probably get into some bits of this. Just preambling this, it's interesting him talking about the fact that even at the time that both him and Burnham, sorry, not Burnham, both him and Francis were being buried and being essentially censored. Because we've had to rediscover, you know, it's only now we're catching up to where they were in the 1990s, but we've essentially lost this 30-year period as the left and the neocons and the establishment has run rampant through all of this. And, you know, they succeeded in that time period, but they couldn't really crush this down forever. But it's interesting seeing how prophetic a lot of that is, even about itself. It's almost like tragically accurate and prophetic about how they are being removed from the public eye by the establishment.
And that's why I think it's so important for Austrians to engage seriously with these thoughts and a lot of the modern the debates over post-liberalism and national conservatism and sort of the modern day offshoots of, you know, the people familiar with these thinkers, because again, like, this was that strength of that intellectual movement, and so, you know, we need to try to recreate, you know, there's sort of crosswinds going on, because in so many of the and because you see the respect that someone like a Francis had for Rothbard, and you know, not an economic writer, but like, you know, there used to be a lot more understanding of the consequences of inflation and the welfare state on the culture of a society. Now we've kind of gotten away from that a little bit. We've kind of accepted, you know, Medicaid expansion. We've kind of accepted some of the welfare state aspects of within this populist right tradition. That's where I think serious engagement, which requires a background familiarity and a respect for this line of political thought, is so important within this particular moment. Because again, it is such a different time, and it's interesting, because, you know, COVID was supposed to be that sort of next ratchet up, you know, and it might still well be, but we'll see how that all plays out. But, you know, we can't allow that ratchet effect to kind of create that new intellectual dark age on the right. And it seems like we're much stronger now that the fortifications going on. I think, you know, we're responding as well as we could hope with the conditions that are out there, but we need Austrian thought to help strengthen the economic side of this, because again, the degree to which economics is not, you can't disconnect that key to the larger debates on culture or power, for reasons that I think Austrians are uniquely equipped to explain.
Yeah, it's about, there's been this kind of political magpieing almost of all these ideas that have been forgotten or suppressed. When we talked about AA earlier, but he's been doing the same thing with people like Evola, mm-hmm. and some of the kind of forbidden knowledge of the more British traditionalists. You've got the same thing when it comes to St. Francis. He's portrayed in a similar way. Both Francis and Evola, to a lot of the, you know, the quote-unquote anti-SJWs I used to collaborate with, those people have a boat. They will read their Wikipedia article and go, I'm not reading this. Those people are Nazis. which is hilarious coming from somebody, you know, supposedly nominally on the right or in the center, because they are mirroring the language of, again, of their supposed enemies. But that is really how successful a lot of this campaign has been. But getting into the article itself, if you want to get that up there, Trig. He first talks about some of the analysis of the day stuff. He talks about Pat Buchanan a little bit. And I know that Francis was quite involved with advising Buchanan, and basically advised him to become Trump in many ways, to go like full populist, to go, you know, essentially to follow Rothbard's, you know, blueprint of the populist right in many ways, to attack the bankers, attack the elites, engage with middle America, promise he'll, you know, essentially, you know, take the whip to the current political class. And Buchanan didn't really do that. But it's, again, it's interesting in a post-Trump age, with some of his kind of more hard-headed kind of political analysis here. He talks about, again, you mentioned it earlier, Evelyn, about politics is a zero-sum game. And all state action is processed by which winners can only benefit at the expense of losers. What was missing, I think, from both Buchanan and Trump was like this intellectualism of Francis and this analysis, yes. And like knowing why the populism works is interesting, because Rothbard in 1993 and before by his other writing is, you know, he's very explicitly saying why the populism works. He talks about Lenin, which is something that only, you know, people on the right have only just started redoing, I guess. But it's kind of funny to see him talk about the hard-headed political realities in a way that is, with a few names switched, would seem revelatory now.
Mm. Well, I think it's a sort of passive acceptance, once again, of this notion that, you know, that claim of politics being a zero-sum game is Marxism, but sort of flipped on its head. you know, as a class analyst that consciously sees the state as the actor that it truly is, it's almost sort of, it's the same sort of thing that Hoppe ended up getting to with his sort of notions of political economy. And it's interesting that despite Rothbard not coming through the same sorts of thinking as, say, for example, Burnham, who was explicitly a Marxist, and then Francis, who studied Marx in the same way later on that Burnham did, that there was that same kind of framework sits throughout the whole thing, and it's, I don't know, it's just a way people really ever want to consider it through, and it's why connecting Lenin to it works, because if anyone cracked how to do populist tactics and populist rhetoric, I think it might have been Lenin. Despite all the Wall Street money he was given, he still had to be effective.
Well, yeah. So, what did you first think when you reread this? Then, like, what was your immediate, like? I don't know. It is a little bit like holy shit, and like I said, the Rothbardian time machine in places. Right. But the stuff about strategy, especially, I think is again very relevant, because it's something that the American right, the nominal neocon right, almost completely abandoned. They completely abandoned the ideas of having actual right-wing strategy outside of just, like you said, with the Medicaid stuff, just accepting parts of what the left wanted.
I know. The good thing is that, like, there's a lot. I mean, I was familiar with Rothbard's other articles, like A Strategy for the Right. Like, you can see him building in this area. And the contributions here, you know, complement that. So I always loves getting as much of that material as possible. But that area in particular, it's kind of reconfirmed some of the, you know, it kind of restated some of the stuff I'd seen earlier. But I think that's also the part. I think it's the reason why there's a lot of libertarians that hate this period of Rothbard is precisely because it was Rothbard at its most effective.
Mm. Yeah,
and I think that's why, you know, if you talk to, like, there's a certain sort of respectable libertarian that will attack this stuff, but they never care about him praising Shea in the 60s, right? Like, but it's precisely the fact that this stuff was dangerous because this stuff was actually making a difference because it was hitting on what was actually at play. I think that has led to some of its historical infamy.
Well, he's talking about that aspect that is always missed when people. Well, not all the time, but when a lot of people talk about populism, that the populism is only as effective as the people who are trying to guide the populace. You know, right. I think one of the paragraphs in the section on strategy essentially suggests, you know, intellectuals and activists spent that whole period of, you know, even from the 60s to the 80s on the right trying to put forward ideas, and the public took them up and nothing happened because there was no strategy about how to effectively force the ideas upon your enemy, which is ultimately what needs to be done.
Very what needs to be done. It's, yeah. Ultimately, it's Rothbard at his most Francian, which is quite, I think people are only realizing that now with the benefit of hindsight and stuff like this. It's like the missing link almost.
Mm.
It's like finding some fossils somewhere and realizing, oh wait, he did actually know about this. I know, Trigg, you've read a lot of the Francis and Rothbard stuff kind of along with me when we did the democratization stuff.
Yes.
Like, what were your thoughts reading this review / essay through? Because it does feel like weirdly prophetic.
It was, yeah, absolutely. The thing that gets to me is that they are starting to talk about strategy. As you say, there's an awful lot of people with an awful lot of ideas, but as the term actually, I just wanted to bring you up on what we need to do is force people to change them. No, we want them to come up with it as their idea, and we want them to push it as much as we push it, and them think it's a great idea. That way we don't end up with what we've had for the last God knows how many hundreds of years of everyone butting heads and usually end up in bloodshed and horrifying nastiness, and it doesn't get any better. In fact, it gets worse, and power is consolidated in the wrong direction. If you can, which we do have at the present moment, which is two populist groups moving around Europe and America and various other things. There is the right, there is the left. We have become so split up from the centre because the centre's moved to the left. that we have now, these two populist groups. If we can make a group of the populists on the left go, hey, you know what? Actually, that's a really good idea. That's where your connection with Lenin really resonates with me. We don't want to come into conflict with them. We want to bring them over. That's how you get a real populist movement. Appeal to the mass of the populace. Get all of them, if you can. At that point, your managerial elites are... Well, they've got to run. They're done for at that point.
That's the bit of the point that this makes, in that he's talking about adopting the revolutionary language.
Yeah.
He's talking about the revolution. And the managerial revolution. And again, I would encourage you though to read Leviathan and His Enemies, because it really continues on from, there's some nuggets of it in this when he talks about the managerial class and some of the Burnham stuff. And really, you know, if you'd read this at the time, it'd only bear fruit like a decade later. You'd be like, oh, that's kind of what he was talking about. Because throughout this entire period, Sam Francis was writing. It took him many years. He was writing Leviathan. Never quite finished doing it, but he was writing it right from the 90s up until his death. And all these ideas really are in it, in a very kind of logical step-by-step. Again, it's funny because this, like I said, is Rothbard at his most Francian, but Leviathan and Its Enemies is Sam Francis at his most Rothbardian, I think. Which is... It's an interesting confluence.
I've already placed an order. I'm very much excited about that.
Well, there's one of the things I quite like about Sam Francis's perspective is he's very big on mass and scale, which always, anytime I see it in any of his writing, my brain starts flashing Ted Kaczynski. Because there's even one in the strategy section here. He's talking by winners and losers, it must be emphasized. Sam Francis is talking about long-run triumph or loss for a movement's basic principles, not about short-run tactics. You know, that very notion, that understanding that if there is a long-run trend, it must then be overset by another long-run trend, not some other short-run trend that doesn't actually trend against it. I know it's a bit sort of a redundant statement, but people don't realise this. You know, they think because there is one subset of policies that are now reformed or right-wing, that the whole other machine hasn't slowly shifted leftwards during the process. And that is almost verbatim Ted Kaye's principles of history as he describes them. I mean, I think even the passage at the bottom is even better. Given the persistent cultural dominance of the left, a conservatism that limits itself merely to procedural problems, tacitly concedes the goals of public action to its enemies and quietly comes to share the premises on which the goal of the left rests. You know, it's a very obvious point that just doesn't get stressed, that if you don't question the process itself, if you're just meandering in the specificities of it and ultimately the managerial aspects of it, you're trying to play them at their own game and you'll always lose at that.
And there's also a tendency, I think, in general, to downplay the significance of the revolutions that did take place, you know, did take place within the form, right? Like, so much of the conservative movement wanted to, you know, and you still see this, like, any constitutionalist today has this sort of noble idea on what their country is. That's what I like when he draws the parallel to Garrett Garrett, some of that old right tradition, because I've always loved that this tendency throughout Rothbard's stuff of getting, really connecting his philosophy back to that old right, and I think it helps kind of make these, you know, this paleo, you know, era work so well, is a recognition of this sort of common tradition. Because again, that notion of the revolution within the form, like, and this is why it always drives me crazy having discussions about, you know, practical politics now, and people are, you know, talking about how, like, oh, well, how can you like the Republicans, and they'll name a list of terrible Republicans, and it's like, it's precisely because I hate these bastards that I'm trying to do what I do, because what you want is a revolution within the form of this organization, the organization being the Republican Party, the same way that we've had these massive ideological revolutions within the state itself, and that old right perspective, I think, is something that... seeing these historical trends is something that I think is important throughout American history as well, because it's great to have these to recognize it and have the philosophical foundations. But I think, you know, recognizing what was the success and failures of the Jacksonians in trying to rein in their own sort of a Cronius revolution that you had after, you know, the period of good feelings, right, was just a period of cronyism and utter corruption. You know, the post-Civil War era of Reconstruction America, the Bourbons fighting that. These historical examples of these revolutions within the form and lessons from it, I think is something where, again, these are the stories of American history they don't want you to understand.
Well, yeah, it's a key part of building any movement that it must have some narrative. I mean, so much of the work we've put into the democratization series is almost, you know, I don't know if I think the last hop I read was The Great Fiction. And a part at the end of that, he's almost basically asking for people to sort of take up the mantle of using these frameworks, using these ideas, go out there and, you know, just study, look at everything and see, you know, what actually was using the rules that, you know, we have in front of us in this article and the rules that are given, say, in Hopper or Rothbard, have actually been victories. What can we look back on as the things to do in future? And as you're talking about there, you know, the Jacksonians having a dual strategy of a populist sort of sentiment of arguments based around, you know, a very sort of them and them versus us simple friend-enemy distinction. Meanwhile, at the same time, operating on a higher level to these goals and these ideals to do with economic policy. You know, that's what we need to be aiming for. And actually, it seems as if it's nowhere near a popular movement, but there is definitely a class of people who are taking up that call and, you know, using work like Francis, Hopper, whoever else, to try and come up with at least something. Let's give people a better story here.
Very tell a better lie. But the... Well, I did see you retweet a thread by someone called Sam Jacobs, which was great. That was a very good thread in which he talks about tactically how a lot of the, I guess, libertarian purists wouldn't hold their nose and, you know, essentially infiltrate the Republican Party, because the Republican Party has been a lot more successful recently at implementing some of the aims of, you know, the nominal LP than the LP has. Even though, you know, it's supposedly full of all these odious people, it still seems to, you know, not even accidentally, but incidentally through the populism, implement some of the ideas that people want. And people don't seem to want constructive change. I know there's been a lot of drama, let's say, in the online libertarian community about being effective and about, you know, what actions individuals and communities can take to both better their lot and constructively move on issues. I know there was the whole blow up about, you know, homelessness and, you know, the, again, this era of Rothbard rearing its head with the infamous unleash the police. People don't read the next line, which is that he basically says to remove qualified immunity and turn everyone into the police, essentially, which is kind of, I don't know. I think people miss, like, quite how based a lot of that is, because he's basically talking about, one, removing the state kind of officiation of the police, and two, creating these, like, neighborhood associations that essentially, like, go around and get rid of the drug dealers. Again, it's Rothbard is most tactical and is most potentially effective, and a lot of people seem to have a huge amount of problem with that. There's almost this idea that some of the paleoconservatives who might be more open to some of what St. Francis is saying are turned off by, like, the Rothbard ethics kind of more ANCAP stuff, whereas a lot of the libertarians who would happily say that they're fans of Rothbard, you know, because of their optics or whatever, or, you know, because they just feel uncomfortable, wouldn't want to associate with St. Francis, when really, to be effective, again, you need to have both. You need to be able to hold the ideas of both in your head. And there's these two groups, you know, you've kind of got the Tucker Carlson conservatives and the, you know, the purist ethical kind of ANCAP Rothbardians who seem to not be able to quite go over that gap and be able to fuse the two together.
One of the reasons I try to go out of my way to really defend 90s Rothbard and the whole paleo strategy stuff, because it is interesting the way it really only kind of works in that perspective, where, you know, it's that's the era that if you embrace, you know, it's weird, and taboo, but you know, every other, but you know, no one expects a kind of a right-wing libertarian to complain about ethics of liberty and some of the stuff in there, right? Like, you know, it's, this is the stuff that you're not supposed to talk about, and that's why I think it's precisely because of its effectiveness. And I the problem I have with a lot of this online drama, like the bum, you know, the get rid of the bum sort of tweets, like so much of that drama, it's not even like sincere in that they're genuinely outraged. It's that they're bored. They're longing for the days where, you know, you could go on libertarian, you know, go on Facebook and act real edgy because you're talking about anarchy and something that you know, people, it's kind of new and hipstery. And now everyone, you know, there's nothing new or interesting about it anymore. It's not edgy. And they've been having the same conversations about COVID, you know, time after time. And so here they got, you know, here's a great topic, just act morally outraged by, to prove that you're the most pure libertarian on the block. And you know, highlight why you're such the better online account. In this, like that, that's kind of the, that's one of the issues with just libertarianism itself, is that it creates this culture of just, you know, libertarians being libertarians for the sake of being libertarian, rather than trying to do anything engaging with the world. And it's precisely like the entire paleo strategy from Rothbard and Rockwell was praxis of separating themselves from that very specific type of person.
Well, I think,
and that's something I think is important.
Part of their reaction, I think, isn't even, it's sort of subconscious. You know, one of the points mentioned here in the article about, you know, that simply a law of nature and any claim otherwise is simply propaganda for suckers. Similarly, in government, there is always and inevitably, as Mosca puts it, a ruling class. You know, these being very frank and upfront about the unegalitarian nature of man, and the fact that that's, you know, one of the elements we could maybe get further down to later on, but almost sort of by design, and that is the order by which we are supposed to all operate. And when you get to the realms of understanding Rothbard to the point where you're willing to use claims of independence via his argumentation to the point where you want to seek power, I think that scares people, because it's, you've gone and used their own ideas to grab power, and they don't understand how, and they don't want to be classed in with you, because for one reason or another, they either don't want power or they don't want you ruling over them.
That's it, isn't it? It's the who rules over whom at the end of the day that causes the problems. And you are right that I've watched the Libertarian Party for years now massively purity spiral and stab itself in the back so many times and for so often. But it's not even a new thing. It's been going on since the 80s. I mean, I don't know why the Libertarian Party even bothers. Anybody who's actually an actual libertarian stands no chance with the LP.
Well, they're not even doing it in a like a good way. They're not making themselves more effective.
No.
They're shutting out anyone who could be effective. And this whole thing, you know, he talks about populist strategy. He talks about, you know, the power of writing populism and the Joe McCarthy test, basically, as well.
Joe McCarthy did nothing wrong. Literally, show me what he did wrong.
He fell for a CIA trick and never got rid of enough communists.
Yeah, well, yeah. Yeah, he didn't finish the job. To be honest, though, that was. I said this the other day on Twitter that when the wall fell in, you know, 89, 91, whatever, whenever you want to call the Cold War over, we all thought that the West had won, and we'd actually opened the door to lose.
I think the lesson from someone, especially like Francis, is that by the time we went into World War One, we had thrown ourselves into the arms of Americans and ultimately thrown ourselves into the arms of neoliberal culture.
We had been thrown into those arms, yes, without a doubt.
It's slightly a shame, actually, that this is one of the points that he brought up that I want to make sure to mention, that somewhere later through in this article, Rothbard kind of glosses over Burnham as someone he sees as almost slightly amoral, which is not 100% true. I haven't read Suicide of the West, but as far as I'm aware, that is an admittance by Burnham that he almost wasn't a cultural conservative because he didn't see a point in it. That things were so far gone that there was so much other Machiavellian things had to happen first before you could even begin to authentically talk to people about things we would consider as conservative values.
Shall we get that thread up then as a bit of a framework to read a bit more of this?
There's just I noticed that as I'm round about where the revolution of the managerial elite heading is, because I was going to suggest that it's
yes, let me find it.
A lot of people miss, I think, how much of Francis is still defending, you know, good conservative morals as well. He's just constantly trying to make the point to people that they aren't worth anything unless you can properly enforce them upon society in some genuine manner. And the shape of the modern institution is almost designed to do exactly that one thing, or sorry, not that one thing and everything else.
Yeah. There we go. Where are we looking for on this?
It was the A thread, but...
I can send you the link for that.
Yeah, just check us the link. I will...
The point being made that we're talking about, though, was the McCarthyism and the idea that, you know, tactically you have to physically remove these people, so to speak. there's something very, very Hoppian about what Sam Francis says and what Rothbard is saying about Sam Francis here, about his appreciation of Joe McCarthy, and that tactically what you have to do is the first thing you need to do is to have a clear idea in your mind of how to remove your enemies from power. And all of the principles and all of the ideas don't work unless you have that. Unless you have this, you know, unless you have a strategy, a presence of mind, and you're not willing to give in to the kind of disavowal of people in the past who've been effective. Like in McCarthy's, Jackson's, all those people who are, you know, demonized by the victorious modern left. I don't know. So what do you think is like the best element of Rothbard's, and I guess Sam Francis as well, strategy in this era then? Like, what are your biggest kind of takeaways you'd wish people would adopt and listen to, kind of from this era of both Francis and Rothbard?
There's a few different strains I think are important. One, I always love the kind of the middle American radical sort of sentiment, the appreciation for how the massive disconnect between your average, you know, flyover country American really lives relative to, you know, the governing elite, and that there's always a tone of that I think is always important. Also, I think there's something to be said, and what I'm trying to do is identify modern day ways of building on it. And one of the things I love about when Francis talks about how, like, you know, one of the keys of conquest is kind of making sure the conquest funds the war, right? You know, that you know, a strength of Caesar was rewarding his soldiers, right? You know, Napoleon was good at rewarding his soldiers. And so what are the battles that we can take on that can not only, you know, make give pain to our enemies, but financially and materially reward us, because that's how you need to create that sort of next generation of elite to get this stuff done. And that's where I think, like, the parallel out there, I think, is obviously the crypto and Bitcoin stuff. And so I think that one of the ways that we can take this great sort of theoretical understanding of the importance of these, you know, this political dynamic is now, so if we identify that Bitcoin and offers an opportunity for people more inclined to oppose the neoliberal regime, you know, and, you know, what can we do with, so for example, you know, state governments that, you know, if you simply change the law in a state like Wyoming, now municipal governments can all start holding Bitcoin of their own. And those municipal governments, like if red states start stacking sats, then you know that itself is a form of self sovereignty against the regime, benefiting from any gains that are made. And so I'm trying to think of other ways in which the gains that we make as a movement can not just make us, you know, psychologically improve our mood, but provide significant strategic advances as we get them. You know, making sure the castles we take are worth having. I mean, I think Francis' stuff is really good on kind of narrowing some of that stuff down.
He did come round to the wrong neighborhood to talk about crypto.
I think crypto's a, it's an exa- I think it's a bit, well, non-fiat stores of value, I would say yes. I think if Texas started stockpiling like gold and silver with the express idea of it making it a bulwark against the federal government from like bankrupting them by withholding funding, like the federal government would shit itself if they did that. If Texas went, right, we are getting gold and we are going to essentially make our own currency on the back of all this gold, like that is something that would that's like a nightmare scenario for the establishment, because they basically have to make war at that point. Because
it does also have the risk of company script. Crypto does. I'm all for trading it and making a little money here and there for it. By all means, go for it. But widespread, vast amounts of cryptos for, you know, oh, you can get paid $40,000 for Amazon, or we can pay you $80,000 Amazon bucks.
I'm not so much interested in kind of crypto as a broad thing, but, you know, particularly Bitcoin. Like the Wyoming bill was very specific on Bitcoin as a way, and I definitely agree. Enough. There's that aspect to it.
Yeah, I agree with you with like non-fiat store of value stuff.
And Texas already has like a gold bank, like that, and some boomers in these positions of power are going to be more comfortable with gold than Bitcoin. It works on both ways.
Yeah, it's a good way of like just moving outside the system and just like doing things. I think you're right. It's just I know me and you, Evelyn, are often, and I guess Pete as well, talks about the Incapistan in people's minds. Mm. And that's where they retreat to when they are asked to do something. It's like they retreat to this idealized version of their morals, and they won't move outside of it to, you know, to do something. But I think that the biggest thing that both Francis and Rothbard are really just telling people to do is like go out there and like fuck these people up politically.
Yeah, just do what they've done to you.
Yeah,
it's a very simple dynamic, but it seems to be one that people, for one reason or another, cannot accept. And maybe, yeah, I don't know, that's something to do with the therapeutic managerial state and its post-revolutionized form or something like that. But
very big mouthful there.
One of the most disappointing parts of the essay was Rothbard going after the Caesarist approach. To be fair, like Reagan, obviously not Caesar. So it's funny to see, it was funny to kind of get that reminder that once upon a time, Reagan was seen as the Trump of his day, and even that's, you know, I mean, it's not surprising, but it's just kind of a nice reminder of how interesting that those conversations were already going on in the 80s.
It's kind of funny, though, that he says that, but also conversely at some point suggests that we need someone who is capable of the will to power a la Lenin or Pol Pot. I always love for a head of state to really overthrow and decimate the existing administrative power structure would require the steely determination and the cadre organization of a Lenin or a Pol Pot, which just makes me think of like DeSantis Ducci.
Yes.
I think I have that image somewhere.
There's the one, what was it we use when we talk about the whole violence in society and the strategy for the populist right stuff, when talking to Louis Levi about that, we had the Tony Soprano on Mussolini that fit far too well.
Yes.
That was quite a good Photoshop.
I mean, that's another one of those examples, though, of areas you're told not to look at. You're told not to read. You know, you're told to read what happened in Nazi Germany, but obviously from the verified sources. And because of that, it gets very difficult to read the stuff that's unverified. But when it comes to Italy, it's not as outwardly prescribed, because I think it's a slightly more difficult situation for them to handle it, because the fascism in Italy was not of the same spirit. It was still very reactionary, but it had people, you know, like Pareto and Mosca and Evola behind it, not the same sort of unbridled German idealism. So it was a lot more careful. And there was a lot of things, even directly from just, you know, as much as Mussolini was a bit of a madman, he had some great ideas going on. And it was, you know, in that same sense as a Lenin or a Pol Pot, he was willing to, you know, engage in action himself along with getting people to engage in the actions that he felt was necessary. It's a shame that sadly he felt to counterpoise himself against the royalty at the time and, you know, turn Italy into a republic and whatever else, but hey-ho, it was a managerial revolution after all.
Well, speaking of tactics and him talking about tactics from the left, he does also talk about Gramsci, which I think is one of the another good part of this article. After the part where he talks about basically McCarthy doing nothing wrong, he talks about the left and Gramsci and how basically they adopted the path of Gramsci. And I do like your point that if you're a leftist and you truly understand Gramsci, you should probably, like, it would have a lot of them have an existential crisis because they'd realize that they are actually living in their socialist paradise. They just hate it.
Yeah.
they're just the proles who were, you know, they're not even in coal mines. They're in like coal centers. It's like even shitter. But yeah, he does talk about, you know, Prato, and he talks about, you know, the Orwell and the idea that the you know, equality is a language that people don't believe in, but the idea that the left especially tactically understood that they had to subvert the West in a way in which it soaked into its culture. And the, you know, the cultural hegemony, Long March through the Institutions, it's all stuff that we know about and, you know, most of us have read before. But it's interesting seeing it recontextualized in this way when he's talking about right-wing strategy. And he's talking, again, they're talking about the Reagan years. And, you're right, the fact that he was seen as something of a Trump of his time. But the Long March is, you know, it's as he says, it's very profitable. It gives them, as they gain institutional power, they're able to offer the carrots to people. And it's a model that I think that the right needs to study. They need to realize that they have to either create their own parallel institutions or, you know, pick something and just go after it in a way that, you know, the left goes, right, you can have that, fine, it's not worth the trouble. And just start picking things off and start, again, trying to absorb themselves into the culture a bit more. Because San Francis was one of the very, very early proponents of the culture war, and that the right had lost it completely. You know, he's talking about this in the 90s. He's talking about in Beautiful Losers, he's talking about the failure of the American right through the 80s, and that the neocons had taken over, and really that the conservative movement was in many ways dead by that point. He was right. Again, 9/11 really sealed the deal. But it was kind of wavering on its feet before that. Again, this article has everything. But when he talks about Gramsci, I think he's really talking about, you know, the successful route to power. And I know you said, though, about states moving outside the system, just starting to do things that disrupt the power base. But like, what is the long term strategy? Do you guys think, like, what is our, like, long march through the institutions? And it's a big question, but like, what he kind of hints at it here. There's the seed of it there, but like, what, like, long term, what do we do? Something that a lot of people are wrestling with.
I think the has to come from decentralization of the monopoly of force. I think it doesn't. This is, you know, Jeff Dice will talk about soft secession and other alternatives there. You know, the plenty of history in America, the ability of making this, you know, work within a united model. But I think ultimately I think it parallels well with what we have seen play out. The areas where the political action has been taken against the left has been at the state level. I think that will continue. I think you can imagine some in the areas where the right can get really aggressive. It's like I can see in the next few years the right, for example, getting serious about throwing out tenured professors in state-funded universities. I think that is a genuine potential achievement at that state level. And I think that is one of those institutions that you could take back. Imagine the what it would change a state if instead of going to college and getting 80-20, crazy leftists and then an occasional New York Times conservative, it is now, Mises Institute type intellectuals, even George Mason types, just the broader right wing, libertarian, whatever, the intellectuals. That would dramatically change what those, and the consequences, the cultural consequences of those institutions in the states, in a way where you already have a very strong stream of money being pumped into it anyway, right? I don't think you're going to get anything to that level at the federal. So I think ultimately what this looks like is nationalism being taken down at a state level, and with legislators willing to act in ways to break up, actually challenge the political norms that prop up the current existing power structure.
Well, yeah, people need to be conscious of perspective, and especially, there's another point I need to make sure it gets mentioned out of it, that the historical perspective, the understanding of the amount of time it has taken to get to where we are and the amount of time it will take to unwork where we are from. And the fact that, I might read a big section of this here, but I just think it's so brilliant, some of the phrasing he has in here. So what are we to make of the striking but highly neglected fact that the brothers Dulles in their private lives before assuming state power were long-time top attorneys for Standard Oil and hence for the Rockefeller World Empire, or that the beloved Herter was married to a Pratt, a family that has associated and invested closely with the Rockefellers since the beginnings of Big Oil in the late 19th century? Are these only coincidences? To believe that strains credulity and can only be endorsed by what my old friend George Resch calls believers in the accidental theory of history. This view of political affairs has long been derided by big intellectuals and big media as a conspiracy theory. There is no theory involved here. However, it is simply a willingness to see patterns that should be staring people in the face. It's one of the things, again, from Rothbard that I was implicitly aware of, and I had been doing it myself years before ever going anywhere near any libertarian theory, but having the proper historiography when you look back at what happened previously. I mean, I think is in Hoppe's Coming of Age with Rothbard, where he talks about, very bluntly, that Rothbard essentially says to him, when it comes to history, just look who profits and look who gains power, and that's always pretty much your safe bet.
Yeah.
And in a sense, I'd been doing that for years and years and years, and then finally get to reading all this stuff, and it's like, no wonder it all makes so much sense now. It is implicitly the logical way to follow conflict in any organization, no matter the size. These basic rules from Austrian economics in terms of seeing games as zero sum or net sum are always true in a sort of perennial sense, nearly.
That gets to one of my favorite parts of this article, where he kind of pokes fun at Sam Francis for not being cynical enough in his analysis, obviously the main drivers behind this is the Rockefellers versus the Morgan family, and like there's so many different parts of Rothbard's library that it focuses on this power dynamic, like all the presidents that are on one side, all the presidents on the other side, and all the consequences of this rivalry. The Federal Reserve and our foreign policy, and the way that the Dulles brothers were all, attorneys for Standard Oil, and so they're all Rockefeller men, and that's just something I love from Rothbard, and that is such something that matters in really diving in sort of stuff, and that's why I love the work of Patrick Newman and what he's doing. We're going to do a series on his a book, and we've talked about possibly down the road on kind of diving into Rothbard's Morgan versus Rockefeller analysis, because it is such an important stuff trying to understand these dynamics.
Is that from inside the progressive era, or is there a separate source for that?
So it touches on it in the progressive era, but the other two, the little handouts, they're I think JLS papers originally. One is the origins of the Federal Reserve, and the other one is something like Wall Street banks and foreign policy or something like that.
We have actually used the origins of the Federal Reserve essay in the Democratization series previously.
Perfect. What I'm surprised is that Rothbard, as far as I'm aware, never bumped into the work of Anthony C. Sutton, but they are so close to doing the same thing at the exact same time. It is almost unbelievable.
Yeah.
Next time I'm at the Institute, I'll see if there's any Anthony Sutton in his library.
I wonder what the footnotes he's written in those books of. Yeah. That's the real jealousy, is that you get to sit and peruse essentially Mises and Rothbard and all these other people's sort of personal library, and you get to have a wee look at all the footnotes and stuff. It just, there must be Rothbard's, some real gems in there.
Rothbard's are particularly colourful.
Well, it's, I don't know, it's kind of funny, Rothbard as well, talking about merely coincidence and not being allowed to notice patterns. That's really quite funny. But he is right when it comes to elite and, you know, again, it'd be nice to have AA here when he talks about elite theory, and that's really the point of, you know, the divide of history, in that history is taught to school children as something that just happens. But, you know, any, you know, non naive analysis of history is something that has been done to you and has been done and was done to people at the time by people with vested interests.
Yeah.
I think any analysis outside of that is, again, almost dishonest by design.
But it brings it back around, because then you see why they needed that long march. They needed that long march so that their history became the history. And you could not look outside of that. That's now why, when you question anything, especially certain events from the middle of the 20th century, you become a complete social pariah, and all you ultimately want out of them is the truth. And you can't behold them.
Well, it's the, again, I don't know if you've read any of Anthony C. Sutton's work, though.
I'm not.
Oh, it's very similar to some of Rothbard's, but it's even more hyper-focused. It's like he took some of the nuggets from it and like expanded them out, because Sutton's work, like, it all hangs together: the Wall Street and the Bolsheviks, Wall Street and the rise of Hitler, and his book on FDR. They all come together very well to show that, you know, it's the same movers and shakers who are making all of these things happen. And he has so much evidence for it. Like, he has the receipts, basically. There's a great passage in, I think it's actually, it's in Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, when he talks about the Nuremberg trials. And he talks about the fact that the German members of the board of IG Farben were prosecuted, but the American members of the same board were not prosecuted. And he says that if the goal of the Nuremberg trials was to distract people from where the money came from, then it was very successful. He just goes out and says that, which is great, because he builds up to it with all this different evidence about these board members, all this American money flowing into Hitler's Germany, all of this American expertise flowing into IG Farben through people like General Electric, and all the stakes that these American businesses who put FDR in place had. And it's just wonderful, because he doesn't arrive at Rothbard's conclusions through like the ethical theory that Rothbard does. He arrives at purely through the facts of history, which is kind of amazing to watch. It's like he studied all of this, and he's like, wait, I see what you did there. I'd highly recommend it, because they're not long reads either.
I'm looking at now. Yeah, no, I'm gonna add. I get a few of these.
Because what we've been trying to do is we've thrown Sutton, Leviathan, Its Enemies, which again almost feels like a reply to some of this article, because I think he's a lot more cynical in his kind of his setting out of, you know, what we call elite theory now.
Honestly, I might need to check. I swear somewhere in the foreword, because I've got my copy of Leviathan here, he explicitly says thank you to Rothbard for pushing me to come to terms with certain aspects that I hadn't tied up of other bits of work, which might honestly be a direct reference to this article. I wouldn't be surprised.
That's kind of amazing.
You know what? Just to tie some connections together, I see that Sutton's work was published in the 70s by Arlington House. That means that Lou Rockwell was a editor at Arlington House.
Oh, it all comes together.
So there might have been some overlap in that.
But there's a bit at the end of this that I want to have a bit of a longer discussion about when he talks about fight the blackout, because I think this is the real kind of prophetic almost black pill here, that he's almost talking directly to us now. it feels like he's like looking into the camera and like talking to us, because this is so relevant.
He's got like the just fuck my shit up fam like hair and eyes and stuff.
He's got like the sad cat eyes. He's got like the shit. What was that dude's name?
Brendan Fraser.
He's got the Brendan Fraser hair on. He's got the sad cat eyes. He's like, please, please don't let this be forgotten. Because he talks about Beautiful Losers, which instead of becoming a staple of the American right, is now an obscure book that you have to pay 75 quid to get a paperback of. He talks about Paul Gottfried's conservative movement, which is a bit more prevalent, but again has been almost completely excised. And you know, he's asking us to do something that the American right in the 90s completely failed to do. He's speaking at a time, you know, where it felt possible, but it, you know, again, we're 30 years later here, and we're kind of picking up the pieces. But there's this idea of like there's all this forbidden knowledge we're piecing together. You know, I'm sure you've read a lot more of other stuff than we have, and you know, where I'm not surprised, but it's so scattered around that we're talking to you, you know, about Leviathan and Anthony Sutton, and all of this stuff hasn't been, you know, pieced back together yet after it was essentially just like scattered by the like the neocon wave of 9/11. It's just the point that like we're kind of almost building things up from zero here. And that we're trying to unify this movement of people who are, you know, are they might be more skeptical and realistic libertarians. They might be, you know, more theoretical and thoughtful, you know, paleo conservatives. But they're all coming towards this idea that like there needs to be something we can use to actually fight, you know, what Francis calls the managerial elite, and finally get rid of their complete hegemony of the hell since 1945. And there's like Rothbard turning to the camera here and just being like, please, please don't let them bury us, essentially. He's like almost begging the audience to go out and seek out these ideas and criticizing the mainstream conservative press, the Washington Times, who I think it was only a couple of years later that Sam Francis was dropped from the Washington Times. Because he said something a bit too spicy about
you know who reported on that.
Who was it?
Dinesh D'Souza.
It was.
Like that just tops it off. It was Dinesh D'Souza was responsible for canceling Sam Francis. The Washington Post.
I think though, I'd be willing to suggest that if Francis wasn't canceled, he probably wouldn't have sat down and wrote Leviathan.
Right.
Possibly not, no.
So
but it's
we'll take one with the other.
It's a great example though that there's all these things that we are now discovering are the essential writings of the political right, and nobody's fucking read them. Something that's probably doomed to have that happen to it is Nemesis by C.A. Bond. That,
yes.
You know, I still have your copy of here. But it was
along with my Schmidt too, might I add.
Yeah, I also have your Sovereign Collection, which again is something you just cannot find in most places. our library. We've got like a copy when it was there, we have like a copy of Leviathan and Its Enemies next to isn't it Technological Slavery it was next to at one point?
There's all sorts of stuff in there.
Yeah, next to a collection of Carl Schmitt's work. Which is
maybe one slightly more, if I'll be allowed to have a silly question before you head off, though. When are we getting some Mises U lectures on Ted Kaczynski? Because that man was on a higher level of axiomatic thinking.
We shall see. Two outlets that I do want to throw out there to you and your audience that might help fill that void in the meantime. You know, we do have the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics, and we do have the Journal of Libertarian Studies. JLS in particular, I think, is a platform that, you know, wanting to write in a longer format, you know, with a little bit more rigor than a traditional blog post. I think there's an opportunity there to kind of dive into some of this stuff and apply it. And what I would love to see is to have, you know, as we rediscover these writings of the right, you know, being able to translate them into, you know, meaningful academic content so that we can all build off of it. And yeah. I think that our journals, we do not require, you know, any sort of, there's not a PhD requirement. There is none of that gatekeeping. We're just looking for quality. And so if anyone in your audience is interested in you know, writing out, building off of these ideas, JLS and QGAE, I think, are two great things. And we also have our Austrian Economics Research Conference. And I think we're bringing back the Libertarian Studies Conference. We've had COVID issues with that one, but those two conferences as well. If you want to start building from this stuff, I really hope anyone out there will consider those outlets.
I was going to say, hopefully my long term plan, if all goes well, is to get to Mises U next year and hopefully walk away from that with something that I can then send over to ARC or whatever the acronym is. I can but only hope that I don't need to get the vaccine to travel, because I'm afraid if I need to get the jab to go, I'm not coming. You need to get a teleporter or something like that.
that's a fear.
We'll put you on the slow boat.
Can I get like smuggled from Mexico to Auburn, Alabama?
Last year we had two students at Mises U from the UK, and that's they went to Mexico and hung out there and then just drove across. That was a dedication.
Great kid. But also like several thousand more dollars than I could afford.
Absolutely. There's a cost that comes into it, but that's the links they had to go to.
Did they cross like the border in the traditional Mexican way, which is like an actual bale of hash and like a hack of AK? I still remember Ian McCollum's thing about that, how they just used to find that stuff in the desert. But that's a different subject. But yeah, there's a lot of people.
I think America, or is it some states, have just implemented a new refugee policy. If you're an LGBT person in Mexico, you can get yourself shipped up for free. We'll have a crack at that.
There you go.
You can be Evelino.
El
Evelino. But I'm trying to think. I've already done the shilling, I think, from our end. But yeah, there's a few things that we've, you know, been kind of involved in a little bit. There's the Shieldings people. We've been trying to get a lot more kind of in-person gatherings. We did our own event in October called Nomos. We're hoping to start planning another one basically like now.
Yeah.
We're in the planning stage of, and hopefully announce that in January for like late March time here in the UK. The other point I forgot to make as well is that the SPLC makes San Francis sound amazing. They're like his hype man.
Yeah.
The Southern Love That You Paused, like their subtitle of his article is "San Francis is the philosopher king of the radical right," which I don't know. I wish someone had called me that.
I do want to mention though before. I don't know, laughing at silly stuff is fun, but it would seem to me like that, you know, if we are doing in-person stuff as we have done, that building whatever people in the UK and possibly Europe, whatever institutions they start to centralise around being on the distant right, you know, we must cross-pollinate with those who, you know, are affiliated with things at the Mises Institute, Chronicles magazine, you know, all these great outlets that used to have people like Francis and whatever else on, because I think as much as we don't like internationalism, we are forced into the position of ultimately being a global protest movement or something of that ilk.
Yes.
And that's I love the work that the friends over at the Mallard are doing, And I think Rothbard has spoken elsewhere. And there's some other articles I've been publishing about the need for a global anti-globalist right, basically.
Mm.
And so that's something I'm going to try to get out there here soon as well.
We're going for Globo Nomo, but no.
I take it, will you be needing to head off then?
Yep. I've got another call with. I'm going to be joining David Gornowski here shortly. So.
Ooh.
Oh, I'm going to have to go as well because I need to go to bed because I'm tired. But it's been very nice having you on, Mr. Tho Bishop. We've been trying to get on as many different people from kind of the dissident right as possible to try and get their opinions. And it was very. Thank you for unearthing this absolute time capsule/ time machine of a Rothbard article because it was a bit surreal to read.
Thank you for reading it, and thank you for enjoying it, and thank you for having me. This has been fun.
Not a problem. We hope to have you again at some point whenever you're free.
Okay, guys, well, that's good night from us then, and we will see you next week. Hopefully, we're not quite sure if we'll have another interesting guest, but do stay tuned.
I'll work something out on Twitter.
We'll work something out. Either Monday or Thursday, we'll probably have someone on. So.